gadgets figured out. I actually forgot to print out the talk, so I have electronic help. So, you know, one of the things that is wonderful and challenging about Zen practice, or maybe any kind of spiritual practice, or any kind of sort of deep work, is you realize something that we're trying to sort of brush over much of the time, and that is that it's actually like really not very easy to be a person. Have you noticed that? If we look in our own mind, and sometimes meditation provides a somewhat shocking view, and we look at our behavior and the way we act and the things we do and don't do and avoid and manipulate, it's a little bit surprising how self-centered we can be, how sort of fragile we can be, how narrow-minded, how easily set off. Things have to be just right, and if they aren't, boy, you're going to hear about it. So easy we fall into a funk. And so easy we beat ourselves up for not being perfect. I had a small example of that on the ferry coming over here this morning. I got the sense that most of the people who ride that ferry ride it like every day and know exactly where you're supposed to line up and when you're supposed to advance and what you're supposed to do. But I just happened to get there like right at, they just, I guess, finished loading all the cars. So I pull up to the head of lane one as I was instructed, and I'm just sort of minding my own business, just relaxing. And eventually I glance up, and there are these guys in these vests, kind of like gesturing, and, you know, one of them starts yelling, and, oh, you know, so I had not done it right, you know. And so easy for the mind in that moment, such a trivial thing, right? But what great ammunition for the narrow mind, you idiot. Now they're, you know. So it's true, actually, isn't it, that it's actually, like, even though we are such privileged people with so many resources and so much going for us and so much education and great support and so on and so forth, if you actually look honestly in the mind, you say, wow, this is like, you know, how does anybody do this, you know? And life is really wonderful, isn't it? Just to be is like enough, you know? This beautiful place that we get to spend the morning. I'm so moved by all the beautiful woods and the bird song and those little paths that you all have created by walking on the grass, you know? So peaceful and quiet. And getting to have friends and loving family. And getting to live in this beautiful world. Sometimes, don't you have that moment of just like, oh, you know, what could be better than this? You know, what could be better than this? Nothing, you know? It's enough just to be yourself, to be connected to others, to be on the planet, to be able to see the beauty all around, the miracles that we encounter every moment. Birds, sunsets, language. You can make a long list of miracles without thinking twice, right? Incredible ingenuity and brilliance of our species and of all species, and the unbelievable intricacy and perfection of this natural world that we are. So, these things seem to both be true, strangely enough. On the one hand, life's a pain and then you die, right? On the other hand, what a glorious thing it is, you know? How amazing. How amazing to be alive. You can feel that. So why do Zen practice? Why do spiritual practice? And I love going to Shabbat, actually. It's really fun. Why practice? Is it like so that we can like get rid of that crazy aspect of ourselves? Sort of manage it or excise it or solve it once and for all? kind of get over our limited view, so that we can just hang out, you know, in the glorious feeling of just being complete and whole. And it might be that we all, one way or the other, feel that way or think that way. We kind of can't help it, and maybe that's why we start doing something like Zen practice, a way to sort of manage and cope, and maybe once in a while to touch that beautiful feeling of oneness and wholeness. And roosters, as promised.
Finally.
So I feel like I really had that idea when I started. As Kushin said, I was only 7 years old, so it's not my fault. But that if I could just like sort of solve this stupid mind, you know, I'd be a lot happier. If I could stabilize the mind, if I could stop being so reactive, you know, if I could become very stable and calm and like Zen, right? Like Zen is religion, one of the few religions that has become an adjective in English. And so we all aspire to be like Zen. And I tried that, and I got pretty good at it. But what I eventually realized was that I wasn't actually doing what I thought I was doing. Maybe I was a little bit. But I wasn't just stabilizing, grounding, you know, resting, like in some kind of calm state. Maybe I was a little bit, but mostly I got really good at suppressing emotion and ignoring things. And that turned out to not be that helpful. I learned the hard way. So, there is so much that's really helpful and beneficial in learning how to manage our crazy mind. Helps us, it helps other people. But it seems like ultimately it is not possible to get rid of your crazy mind. And you are welcome to prove me wrong. Let me know if you can get rid of your crazy mind and just rest in a beautiful field of contented awakening 24/7. That would be great. And maybe one or two people who think they've done that, you know, have some great books and you can read their books. Go to their workshops. They're probably expensive, but that's okay. It'd be worth it, you know? It'd be worth it. Now I think that practice is not about getting rid of one side of our experience so we can hang on the other side. But that would be like inherently lopsided. Now I think, and you know, one's thinking continues to evolve because none of us, as Kushin was saying about the chanting, none of us really knows what we're doing, you know, or what this all means, you know. But now I think practice can really support us in stabilizing the mind, but in stabilizing the mind in a way that's so broad and so open and so like permissive and allowing that we can have both and we can learn to move a little more flexibly and a little more fluidly between the dumps and the joys, the narrowness and the understanding, the judgment and the compassion. That maybe practice can help us be more relaxed and fluid and accepting of this whole arc of human experience. And maybe in the end, practice is about being fully human, which includes both sides. And surprisingly to us, I think, as individualistic people in an individualistic culture, you actually can't do this on your own. So Zen emphasizes community practice. Here we are all sitting together, all trying to do the same things together, although we didn't know how to get out of the room exactly. But Zen practice in its structure and feeling has a great way of reminding us that we can't do this on our own, that so much is learned about this full human experience and about our capacity to be more willing to be who we are in collaboration, in community, and in connection to others. Even though maybe there's a part of us that's probably in that first half of our brain mostly that thinks, I should be able to figure this out, you know? But we can't. We actually can't figure this out ourselves. Only together can we do this practice. And so just like we have sort of two sides to our experience, it's also useful to have two major aspects to our practice: gentle, steady practice, coming here for a couple of hours, paying attention for the rest of the day, enjoying the afternoon, sitting a little bit at home maybe. It's good to have gentle practice, and it's also helpful to have strong practice. Yesterday, the community here practicing with some vigor, I'm sure, all day, you know, probably in silence, probably lots of meditation. And I was recently with my community enjoying a 7-day retreat with our teacher, and then right after that I went to visit our monastery, so the strength of practice is in my mind too. So it's a very broad way. And the other way that this reminder that we don't do this on our own has been sort of built into Zen Buddhism is that there's a wonderful ideal. There's a wonderful ideal of the accomplished practitioner, which actually the ideal is not to be a Buddha. You would think, you know, we have all these Buddhas hanging around, not to be like sort of an awakened person floating around in space, like content, you know, except for when you have to, you know, drop down to earth to do your workshops. But the ideal is called the Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva. And these are beings who devote themselves to community, to helping, and to supporting everybody, everybody in this grand project of opening to their whole lives. And I want to talk a little bit about some advice from the 12th century about how to be a bodhisattva. I'm just hoping my introductory remarks didn't use up all the time, but we'll see. There was a great Japanese Zen teacher, Zen master named Eihei Dogen, and maybe my friend Echo Jeff Kelly has talked about him here before, if you were here when he's been here, and he was here yesterday, I guess. But, you know, each religion has their hero, right? So the Rinzai family, you know, has, you know, Master Rinzai, and the Soto family has Master Dogen. But we turn out to be closer cousins than we thought. You know, once we hang out together, we realize, oh, we have more ancestors in common than we thought. So anyway, Dogen, who is famously difficult to read, actually, and a little bit intimidating because he writes these very intricate sort of philosophical texts about the nature of reality, also wrote a beautiful piece of advice called The Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. And so what I want to suggest is that listening to this advice, taking this advice to heart, and being interested in this ideal of the Bodhisattva, the being who helps others, including ourselves. There's a famous story about, so it's sort of a very compassionate path, compassion and wisdom path, and so I'm going to digress for a minute. But there's a famous story about the Dalai Lama, because the reason why I thought of the story, I'll tell you why I thought of it and then I'll tell you the story. The reason why I thought of it is the minute I think we hear a being who helps others, we say, yeah, that's right. I got to get really good and strong and skilled and figure out how to help all those people over there. And it's going to be really hard, but I'll just work really hard at it and I'll be really good and really help them. And I'll just keep that up as long as I can, you know. Just kind of like an individualistic approach. Me over here would help other beings, which is not really what they meant in the Buddhist tradition. When they say a being who helps others, they actually mean that we are fully included. So there's a kind of a separation that comes so quickly into our mind. So here's a story from the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, you know, is into science. Since a young age, you know, he would sort of tinker with bits of Western technology that had been left by explorers and stuff, you know. And it's so interesting to be somebody who went in person from a sort of medieval feudal life to the 21st century in one lifetime. He just turned 80 on Wednesday, by the way. Anyway, the Dalai Lama for some years has been having meetings with leading psychologists and neuroscientists and, you know, Western science, representatives of Western science that are studying the mind, studying the brain, studying in emotional states and studying the ways that people connect or don't. And they were talking about compassion. And one of the Western scientists said, well, how do you help your monks with the big problem of not being compassionate towards themselves? And this conversation was sort of happening half in English and half with translation. And so this question comes in, how do you help the monks, you know, be compassionate with themselves? And the Dalai Lama like immediately like huddles with the translator. You know, back and forth, and the translator asks a clarifying question, goes back and forth quite a while. And then finally the answer is, I'm having trouble understanding your question. Why would you not be compassionate towards yourself? So maybe it's kind of a Western thing that we separate in that way. Who knows? So here is Dogen's advice for being helpful to others, which include ourselves. You know, not to separate in that way. He suggested four methods of guidance. The first is to practice giving. To give ourselves away to others. And it really encourages a very wide view of what giving is. Because again, our mind is so good at separating, right? We think, oh, right, I gotta think of something good. I'm going to visit Puget Sound Zen Center. I gotta think of something good to give that they'll like, you know, and then they'll like me. You know. That we separate giver, gift, and receiver. So this style of giving is a little broader than that. That we undermine the practice of giving when we force all kinds of requirements and parameters on it. Dogen wrote, you can give even a phrase or a verse of truth. So just give somebody a phrase, you know. It will be a wholesome seed for this and other lifetimes. Give your valuables. For instance, give a penny. Your valuables, okay, I give away all my money. Give a penny, you know. Give a penny. Give a blade of grass. And this will be a wholesome root for this and other lifetimes. So the power of giving goes on for lifetimes to come. It's not just like, well, that was nice, you know. Bigger than that. The truth can turn into valuables, and valuables can turn into the truth because the giver is willing. So how can we work with our hearts to become willing to fully give, And it's quite a bit more detailed than I have time for, but he goes on to talk about how the extent to which we want to not separate ourselves from this process is that we even consider our body itself, to be a gift. He writes, if you study giving closely enough, you see that to accept a body and to give up the body are also giving. That's interesting, huh? To accept a body is a gift. And to give up the body is a gift. Different from how we usually think. And he wrote that giving is such a powerful thing because it really helps people to grow and change. He wrote, even when you give a particle of dust, you should rejoice in your own act because you have authentically transmitted the merit of all the Buddhas. And you're beginning to practice an act of a bodhisattva. So getting anything is big. And this is the interesting part. This is like 12th century. How did he know, you know, this next part? The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. That's true. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. Keep on changing the mind of sentient beings through giving. From the moment you offer one gift to the moment that all beings attain the way. So the power of giving changes minds. So that's the first of the methods of guidance. Practice giving. Just figure out how to practice giving and be curious how you can give in a way that feels more complete, more connected, more whole, less separation. And the great way to do this, I think, practically speaking, and Zen is really good at this, is notice your own suffering and joy. Notice your own pendulum swinging between narrow-minded judgment and perfection and whatever else, enjoying connection as you contemplate giving. And we all know those voices, right? So play with those voices. This gift isn't good enough. I'm going to practice giving anyway and give it. She didn't like that. I'm still going to practice giving. And then he suggests two sort of variations. There are four methods, the second method and the third method of guidance for us in this practice of being a bodhisattva, being a full connected human being, are really kind of highlighting some aspects of giving. The second method of guidance is kind speech. Kind speech. And what a deep gift that can be. I'm really myself trying to continue working on offering kind speech. Sometimes I don't offer kind speech just out of assumptions, you know. I assume everybody already kind of knows, you know, that I appreciate them and appreciate what they do. And so I don't really get around to kind speech, so I'm trying to remember to open my mouth, you know. Which is interesting, being a representative of a religion that values silence so much. But sometimes you got to open your mouth to practice kind speech. To say thank you, to express appreciation. And we're surrounded by people practicing kind speech, so the other aspect of practicing kind speech is to receive kind speech. Before the guys in the little vest were kind of hollering at me, the woman who took my money was very kind. She was admiring the image on my credit card. She said, "Oh, that's really beautiful." I said, "Thank you." Because it really felt good, you know? She didn't have to have a personal interaction with me. She probably takes credit cards from about 17,000 people a day. But she chose to practice kind speech and connect with me. And I really appreciated it, and I said so. Dogen wrote, "If kind speech is offered, little by little, kind speech expands." It's like ripples that go out. Thus, even kind speech that is not ordinarily known or seen comes into being. So your kind speech kind of invites more kind speech. Be willing to practice it for this entire present life. Do not give up. World after world, life after life, those who hear kind speech from you have a delighted expression and a joyful mind. Those who hear of your kind speech will be deeply touched, and they will always remember it. So this is a big statement, you know. He doesn't often make these kind of emphatic statements in his writing. And, you know, we could spend a few weeks on other examples of Dogen for context, but next time. So this is very enthusiastic for Master Dogen. This really works, he says. People will be deeply touched. And can we practice kind speech even when we're not in a good mood? When we're at that end of the pendulum, we're grouchy, we're judgmental, we wish that we and others were other than the way they are. Can we practice kind speech even when we're confronted with someone we think of as an enemy? As an enemy. I ran into a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. "Discover the element of good in one's enemy. Every time you begin to hate that person, realize that there is some good there, and look at those good points which outbalance the bad points. There is a recalcitrant south in our soul, revolting against the north of our soul. There is something within each of us that seems to cry out with Goethe, 'There is enough stuff in me to make a gentleman and a rogue.'" There's another expression of pendulum, right? We're all a gentleman, a gentle lady, and a rogue. So Dogen goes on to offer a third variation of kindness, of giving. So we have giving, we have kind speech, and his third method he calls beneficial action. Beneficial action. So what do we actually do with our body? This is the work of harmonizing ourselves with others. Before I do the chanting at home, we chant "I take refuge in Sangha before all beings, bringing harmony to everyone." So the jewel of Sangha is here, bringing harmony to everyone. How do we do that? How do we bring harmony? And how does it feel when we don't want to bring harmony, right? So the great thing about these suggestions for practice is we can be very inclusive. So a great way to study beneficial action is to notice when we do the exact opposite, right? When we're divisive, narrow, you know, dismissive of others. And then we can see, oh, that's helping me learn about beneficial action. Now let's try the other way. It's always two sides. So the last of Dogen's four methods of guidance is really interesting. I think all he said so far is really quite universal, you know. There's sort of a spirit, flavor in what he said so far of sort of non-duality, you know what I mean by that, kind of learning the way the mind separates things into this and that, and can kind of weave it back together. But I think everything he said is very common to all systems of ethics, philosophy, religions. All practices suggest kindness, right? Suggest awareness. This last one gets interested in the way that we identify, the ways that we take on roles and believe in those roles and become those roles. The fourth method of guidance he calls identity action. Identity action. And he's sourcing something in earlier Buddhism, which I haven't been able to figure out yet, because I've never anywhere else besides this essay seen this particular expression, identity action. So may I let you know if I found out more about where he got this. But this is the action of using roles and identities for the benefit of others. We tend to use roles and identities for the benefit of this guy, right? We go through a certain arc, cultural, family, educational arc, and we take an identity. I'm an engineer, right? I'm a priest, I'm a mother, I'm a something. And we get quite fixed in our identity, in our role. And if anything threatens our identity or our role, especially our own mind, we get really upset. It's very difficult, right? Maybe I'm not good enough to be an engineer after all. Maybe this was all a big mistake, you know? So a deep Mahayana thought from this ideal of the Bodhisattva is that Bodhisattvas learn to use roles and identities very flexibly, very beautifully, very softly. So that's kind of what this last section is about. So let me tell you a little bit about this, and then we'll have a little time for conversation. That a Bodhisattva takes up an identity and a role deliberately in an effort to help others. And when that identity becomes not so useful anymore, she sets it down. She lets it go. Whether this is cleaning toilets, taking money at the ferry, giving the Dharma talk at Puget Sound Zen Center, the Bodhisattva moves fluidly into a position in which they can do the most good, be the most helpful. And sometimes, you know, when you hear about all this meditation stuff, it sounds like it's sort of about abandoning all sort of meaning and going beyond concepts, and there's a sort of a feeling to that that's very wonderful. But the Bodhisattva ideal says, yes, that may be true. And these kind of mysterious things we chanted suggest that it may be true that all of our concepts and ideas are a little bit not quite right. But when the Bodhisattva takes on a role, she takes it up thoroughly. He takes it up as best he can. Takes the seat is a great Zen expression. Take your seat, which is in English too. Dogen talks about identity action as a way of growing up, a way of maturing in the deepest sense, a willingness to face the world in a strong and dignified way so that we can be of benefit. He wrote, action, so the kind of action you take in identity action. Action means right form, dignity, correct manner. This means you cause yourself to be an identity with others and cause others to be an identity with you. So it's a mutual exchange. However, the relationship of self and others varies limitlessly according to circumstances. So there's no operating manual here. It's being very flexible, very fluid. He wrote, this relationship of self and other varies limitlessly according to circumstances. So we're never quite sure. So we can't rest in our identity knowing, okay, I got this figured out, you know, I'll be a school, and my career path is a good example of this. Okay, I'll be a school teacher. Oh, that didn't work out. Okay, I'll do this. Okay. Everything's always changing, right? Sometimes this involves doing what comes really naturally. It can be very easy. Other times, the world calls on us to stretch and grow and enter into a new role or a new situation that is far from comfortable. I'm sure we all have many examples of this in our life story. Because life offers us so many trainings in this. So many trainings in identity action. What's the identity to take? What's the action to take here? So we learn from our suffering. We learn from our joy. We learn from others. And we learn how much better it feels in the end, even if it's hard, to accept the challenge of this life fully. And he also goes on to say, if we don't do this, it's not just like, whoops, missed opportunity, you could have helped a few more people. If we don't do this, we don't show up for our lives fully in this way. Dogen actually suggests that the whole universe is a little bit messed up by that, and it has a powerful negative effect. And he uses a little poetic metaphor. He often uses the metaphor of mountains and waters. He writes, "The ocean does not refuse to be water." The ocean does not refuse to be water. That's good, huh? That's why the ocean is large. The mountain does not refuse the soil. That's why the mountain is high. A wise lord does not exclude people, and that's why she has many subjects. This being so, water comes together and forms the ocean. Soil piles up and forms the mountain. Because mountains do not exclude mountains, they are mountains, and they are high. Because a wise lord does not weary of people, the people assemble. So yeah, think how messed up things would be if water refused to be part of the ocean, you know? Ferry wouldn't work too well. And so just a poetic way of saying, well, what happens when we refuse to actually be ourselves, when we're not willing to show up? Not just for our own well-being, but also for the harmonious function of the world, is the suggestion here. Why would we make this effort to live fully for ourselves and for others, and to develop the skills and the curiosity? I think mostly the curiosity. Skills are a little bit bound by the context in which they're learned, right? So we also need very much curiosity and creativity. And sometimes this identity action is amazingly creative. At the retreat I was just at with my teacher, Norman Fisher, he retold a story, which I want to tell you as closing. It's a story about the French surrealist poet Robert Desnos, who was most active in the 30s, I think. He's French, half-Jewish person. And so he stayed in France. I guess he could have left, but he stayed in France. He was in south of France, and he was a resistance person under the Vichy government. But sooner or later, Robert Desnos was caught, like so many were. And here's the story. He and others had been in a concentration camp for some years. And then one day, along with many others from the camp, he was hauled away in a truck. They're crowded in the back of this large truck, and they know they're being taken to the gas chamber. So the mood is somber, nobody speaks, and when the truck arrives, it is completely silent. Even the guards can't say anything and just use gestures to unload the prisoners, to unload the condemned from the truck. And they're lining up, and suddenly the silence is interrupted by an energetic man who jumps into this line and grabs the hand of one of the condemned. Improbable as it is, the story goes, this is Robert Desnos. And he proceeds to read the man's palm with a lot of enthusiasm and joy. Oh, he says, I see a very long lifeline. And you're going to have 3 more children. Robert Desnos is exuberant, and his excitement is contagious. First one man and then another holds out his palm to be read. And the prediction each time is for longevity, more children, and abundant joy. As Desnos reads more palms, not only does the mood of the prisoners change, but the mood of the guards changes too. How can one explain it? Perhaps the element of surprise has planted a shadow of doubt in their minds. Maybe before they told themselves that these deaths were inevitable, but now this no longer feels true. And they're in any case so disoriented by the sudden change of mood among the prisoners, among those they were about to kill, that they can't go through with the execution. And all the men, along with Desnos, are packed back into the truck and taken back to the camp. Robert Desnos saved his own life and those of the others using his imagination. So strange example of identity action. And I guess historians have tried to figure out if this really happened, and there's no evidence one way or the other, but the story lives on from the 40s. It was close to the end of the war, actually, so Robert Desnos and presumably most of these other men survived to liberation. But our practice doesn't always give happy endings either. He died of typhoid a couple of weeks later after liberation, of typhus. So who knows how it all works, really. But my practice now, I'm really trying to learn how to be more fully human, how to really feel and appreciate the full range of human experience, including when I'm closed, including when I'm unhappy, including when things are not going my way, and to practice kindness and compassion for myself and others, try to enter the roles that will help be kind, speak kindly, be of benefit. So oddly enough, I think Zen, for all of the sort of somber mood of the form and the repetition that we have, you know, for coldness and intensity, whacking with sticks and so on, maybe in the end, this quiet practice is about jumping out of the truck, you know. It's about love, it's about connection, but a love and a connection that is powerfully real and mutually sustained by all of us working together. So that's my talk. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you very much for the invitation. It's like, it's so fun, you know, to go somewhere where it's like almost what you know what to do, you know? Like we always chant after the sitting, and you chant before the sitting, and I'm like, wow, you know, that's so interesting, you know? And, you know, we leave the room in a different way, bow in a different way. Yeah, so it's really
almost
fun.
Like you have to take on another identity.
Yeah, you have to take on another identity and then be humble and like, no, I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. Be guided like a little duckling. So do you have any thoughts or comments or ideas?
Actually, it was also, I think, Anne Frank that died of typhoid fever or some kind of pneumonia. So
pneumonia.
The hope of surviving. So it makes me think of why do bad things happen to good people, or why do good things happen to bad people, that the guards just had an attack of consciousness or something.
Yeah.
That they became human at that moment.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that there's a part of our mind that so wants to understand and have a reason, right? Why could it be this way that it is? Yeah. Which is a great motivator to keep learning, but also, I think, ultimately limits us because, you know, does it make sense? I don't know. I don't know if it all makes sense. Will it ever make sense? I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. Yeah, Anne Frank worked so hard to survive, right? And then they didn't survive. Her family. Anyone had any really humiliating moments lately? That's like what we learned from. Go on, you're going to say something else, probably.
Just to follow up on what you were saying, there was a poet, philosopher named Jacques Lucien. Frenchman, and he was blind. And he was taken away into a concentration camp. And he's written some wonderful books, very, very inspiring books. And there's a moment in time where he speaks about everybody being absolutely terrified, similar to the example that you were sharing. And he just, and again, he's not able to see anything, so he's living out of this other sense realm. He just started reciting one of his favorite poems.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he said he could feel everybody just coming around him, drawing closer.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, because he's experiencing so much on the feeling realm, the whole mood of the room changed.
Yes.
And so in this book, he doesn't try to understand what that was all about. For him, it was enough that it just
mm-hmm.
happened.
Yes.
And I thought that that was so beautiful, that it was enough that it just happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a lovely example. Yeah, can we learn to just trust our instincts, right?
I think I really appreciate you emphasizing that point today.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes it looks like the Zen school, or Zen, or meditation in particular, is kind of about just following. You know, like following your breath,
mm-hmm.
following in line, following in step, you know, like doing all of the being good and quiet and disappearing.
Yeah.
But there's this other aspect which I don't know how to teach exactly, to be honest. Or, you know, I mean, and I don't have it that well myself, you know, that great myself. But, and that is to jump into a new identity. You know, I mean, I say new identity, not something totally lunatic necessarily. That was kind of lunatic.
Yeah.
Read the poems. But to practice jumping into something new, you know, without holding on. And the meditation should help with that. I believe that, because it's, you know, we're shedding our regular everyday way of doing things, you know, our regular identity, just shedding it into no identity.
Yeah.
But then the challenge is to be able to pick up a new identity, like, you know, dumbass identity, you know, because you do something dumb, you know, or from not feeling great to compassion, you know, to loving identity, and to be able to know yourself well enough and to be able to call upon those kind of freely. It's like you said, take the seat. Take the seat of compassion, take the seat of strength, take the seat of this and that and the other.
Yeah.
And to be able to do that, a little bit like this morning, where you just had to take on, all of a sudden, take on jiu-jitsu, yo. You know, and there is that, that's one of the wonderful things about those little surprises in a monastery, and sometimes they're, you know, the teacher wants them to happen, messes things up, so that they will happen.
Yeah, you can kind of count on life to provide those kind of moments.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not to resist them, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But to jump into them.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a way that the apparent stability of things lulls us, you know what I mean? Like, oh, everything's fine, I don't have to do anything. And I was thinking about this with all the wildfires. That we actually have a wildfire, you know, 10 miles from Bellingham. Usually the wildfires are like way on the other side of the mountains, far away, read them on the news, you know. And there's like a wildfire in my neighborhood, you know what I mean? Like, what's to keep my city from burning down, you know? So nothing, you know what I mean? There's a kind of way that we rest in sort of an illusion of permanence and stability, that everything's fine, but nothing, you know what I mean? Things are always changing, right? And so, yeah, there's a way, I think, of, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, but you know what I'm trying to say? Like, we need to, it would be good if we could learn to be a little more available to change, you know what I mean? There's change is happening all around us all the time, right? Climate change, for one thing. So how do we show up for that?
And to be ourselves able,
and be ourselves.
Able to change and meet, adapt different circumstances and not become stuck or rigid.
Right. Yeah. Right, yes.
I think that's one of the hoped for benefits of practice.
Yes, yes.
I have a question about when you have the impulse to give kind words or give gifts or action, because you never really know it will be able to receive in that way.
Right.
Do you recommend that a person just go with that impulse because it's coming from love or the desire to be kind?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's a very good question. So sometimes they say Buddhism is sort of like balancing sort of two big sort of trainings, and one is compassion, kindness, and the other is wisdom. So yeah, I mean, there's times when it's kinder to give somebody space, right?
Right.
So what's kind, you know, so kind speech could be saying something loud, or kind speech could be quiet kind speech, you know. So, you know, I think it's just, like you said, there's an infinite kind of number of variations here, different personalities and different situations, so... I think it's a great sort of, life gives us a sort of laboratory of experiment, you know, and we can try it one way and see what happens and try it another way. But I think the important thing here is our intention, And so our intention is towards kindness, towards connection, towards kind speech. And so we're trying to discern, you know, from experience and wisdom and, you know, our best guess, would it help right now to say these words out loud? And probably more often than not it would, you know. But there are certainly times when it's better to just leave people alone, right? You know, yeah. But we do so out of kindness, see? Yeah. Yeah. What's your sense so far?
I think that sounds like good guidance, what you just said. And I'm also aware of second-guessing things so much sometimes that
right.
maybe I don't do an action and
right.
that... that could be a problem right there.
Right,
you
right.
Just go with it and not
right.
think it to death. And,
right.
I think there's always a risk of if you act, maybe you're going to be humiliated, and so you stop and you hesitate.
Right.
And I think sometimes just go for it and
yeah.
forget it. If you do get embarrassed because the other person is totally
yeah.
resistant to that, then oh well.
Yeah, and that's kind of like this last thing, be willing to enter into humility, you know, be willing to be humiliated, right?
Right.
But the other thing, I think, I love what you said about second-guessing, and just the way you said that, I think reminds us of the way the second-guessing kind of mind is so separating, right? Then you're not there anymore, you know what I mean? So kindness, and, right, you're gone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, so these practices are suggesting ways to support connection and exchange. And yeah, when the mind kind of goes to fear and second guessing, yeah, you're isolated again. Yeah, so that's good that you notice that and can practice with it. And, you know, be real with it. There it is, you know. And what's beneath that? Oh, you know, there's a part of me that really doubts myself 24/7 and is afraid. And you know, okay, you know. Hi. Yeah, maybe one more. I think we're probably about out
yeah,
of time.
Yeah, I think we're
yeah.
about out of time.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to say what comes up in me about your question is that sense of compassion for self.
Yes.
And that impulse, anyway, to speak for myself, that impulse I have to offer something to someone, an action or a word, and compassion for myself, then I can ask them by revealing what's true for me. I'm feeling hesitant. I don't know if it would be, if I have an impulse to offer something and I don't know how you'd receive it, and I'm checking with you if you would like to hear from me or have this action or whatever it is, and that involves the other person as well. Then it's a shared decision. It's part of that being a community,
mm-hmm.
right? It's offering to offer yourself to someone and then seeing how they would receive it before doing the actual offering.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
making sense. Kind of.
Yeah, that can be very kind. Yeah, to ask permission and to what you, first thing you said, like to be vulnerable, you know, display your vulnerability,
yeah.
but still always we're interested in, you know what happens, right? I mean, sometimes that kind of acting feels like a manipulation, sometimes it feels like a genuine connection, and when, you know, it's interesting, but that's a great point, yeah. We can be vulnerable and ask permission of each other. and let ourselves down a little bit from this great requirement we have in our mind to always know what to do, right? You know what I mean? Like,
and that's
I don't know what to do here,
yeah.
you know? Right,
yes.
yeah. You know what? I'm feeling worried. I'm not sure what to do. I'm, you know,
yeah.
I really like you. I was going to say something here, but, you know.
Yeah.
Beat me up. I don't like that. So anyway, thank you so much, and thanks again for the invitation. And those of you just dipping your toes into Zen today, thanks for being courageous to try that. It is a little bit strange looking. And you know what I've been doing lately? Last thing I'll say is it's really good to take up something where you don't know what you're doing. And remember that.
To take what?
Take up something where you totally don't know what you're doing, you know, and remember, you know, how it is when you first come into Zen. Anyhow, I'll save that story for later.
Just before we break up,